So I'd like to talk with you about my teacher, Darlene Cohen. And I want to start by acknowledging a couple of people who came from far to be here this evening on this rainy day. Malcolm and Ingrid. Where is Ingrid? Oh, there you are. Thank you both so much for coming all this way to be here this evening. These folks are from the Russian River Sangha in Guerneville and came to be with us for the evening. And it's always so lovely when people make so much effort to be body to body with others. And I'm so appreciative of your effort. Thank you very much. And, you know, Darlene loved rain. So I actually think it's perfect that this happened to be on a rainy evening. And I'm trying something new with my paper, so forgive me if I fumble a little here. Frankly, I just had to make it big enough to see. And in so doing, I ended up with multiple sheets, which I don't like, but I'm adjusting to aging. So I, as is my habit, I would like to pass out photographs to you of the person I'm speaking about. So there are two photographs of Darlene here. And I'll just start then here, and maybe I can cross the altar really carefully. Thank you. So there's two photos here on this. The one in the brown robe was taken here at Santa Cruz Zen Center on the day that Dana and I were ordained. This picture is very precious to me, and it's very personal to me. And I'm sharing it with you because you're my Sangha, and I want you to have this very personal feel that I have about my teacher. But I'm going to ask you not to reproduce these pictures, not to duplicate them or reproduce them with scanners or any other technology, simply because this one is very personal to me, and this one I don't own. So I have permission to give it to you, but I don't have permission to have it proliferated. So, but you know, I just think it's really nice to see an image, to have a face with the name as I talk about her. And I think these pictures actually reflect her nicely as a pair, because this was a person who definitely had all sides to her. She was very funny, very, the picture, this purple robe was her selection, this purple. It was lavender, I guess. But she chose this color, and her Sangha sewed this robe for her. This was a 9-panel robe that her Sangha gave her in October of last year. And, you know, she was so happy. I mean, it's practically sacrilegious, but she was thrilled. And, you know, you can see in the look on her face there, you know, how moved she was. And just she just had really what I would consider a perpetual look of mischief on her face. And a little bit unexpected what she might do next. So I'll start with a story, which is that when last time I was at Tassajara with her, she became very ill during the study week. And they called an ambulance to get her, which is really unusual. I mean, she was bleeding, and it was thought that, you know, this was she had cancer, and it was uncertain what was going to happen. So she called all of us to her cabin, and she was laying in the bed, and we're all, you know, somber, thinking this is our Vimalakirti moment, you know, when she's going to do her deathbed thing with us before she goes off in the ambulance at the monastery. And we all get in the room, and we're all in our robes, and we pile in the room, and we're all standing around the bed, and all of a sudden, out come squirt guns. And she completely, you know, we're sopping wet by the time it's done. So this is her Vimalakirti moment, her deathbed moment, was the double-barreled, you know, squirt guns in the cabin at Tassajara. So that's a very typical story of Darlene, and everyone who knows her, you know, knows this. You have to, if you're going to be a student of Darlene's, the one rule is you do have to find a squirt gun that doesn't leak. Because if you put a squirt gun in your robe pocket and it leaks, believe me, this is not pretty. So the skill is just finding one that doesn't leak, and, you know, so very important tool when you are a student of Darlene's. So rather than try to do a survey of her teachings, which are vast and wide, frankly, I mean, I have studied, you know, read, she's written 4 books, She has, been speaking for 30 years or, 25 or 30 years, has recorded talks back that long, has been teaching for that long. And she had a lot of complexity and depth to her teaching. So rather than try to capture all of that, which I almost despaired, trying to give a 20-minute or 25-minute talk about her and capture her. So rather than try to say everything, I thought I would just talk about the ways that she impacted me most, the areas in which her teachings most affected me. And because I really believe that she was extremely personal in her teaching. She worked with each individual as a unique expression of the Dharma and met everyone in that way. So my guess is if Malcolm was giving this talk or Ingrid was giving this talk, they would be very different talks. Because my guess is we have different lives, and so she met each of us where we were. So this is my version, and frankly, volumes could be written, I believe, on her teaching. But let me start with besides the ones she wrote. So I want to start with how I met her. I met her at Green Gulch Farm at a workshop, a day of practice for people with pain. And Catherine Thanis, our abbot, referred me to that workshop because she had asked me to teach one here and then found this one online. And so I went to the workshop at Green Gulch, and the very first thing that happened was what I like to call Zazen instruction, Darlene style. Very different from Zazen instruction that you encounter usually. She had, she had rheumatoid arthritis and had had it, as her mother did, since she was in her early 30s. And so that her body of pain and disfiguration meant that she could not just plop her body into Zazen posture and look good doing it. She had a lot of pain, and she couldn't just, sit cross-legged. In fact, I don't know that she could sit cross-legged at all by the time I met her, and probably for years before that. So what that caused her to do is sort of pressed her to penetrate Zazen. What really is Zazen beyond the physical form, which, of course, Zen emphasizes physical form, and it's very, very important, the form of Zazen. The posture of Zazen is extremely important, and she completely acknowledged that. And in fact taught traditional postures. She taught people how to sit in traditional postures without doing it herself. She also taught alternative postures for Zazen. And I remember in this workshop, early in the workshop, she did a demonstration of lying down postures. And it was the first time I had ever actually seen someone formally teach that. And when she took the Zafu, the person's now lying on the floor. She took the Zafu and put it on their chest. I just wept because I had struggled for 16 years to sit on the Zafu. And what I didn't get until that moment was that the Zafu sat on me. That was the solution. And I just cried. I mean, it was just a floodgate. So in my first meeting with her, in the first, 2 hours of my time with her, and there were 20 other people there, she transformed my life completely. Because she took what was essentially a torturous process for me of sitting Zazen and turned it into the Dharma gate of ease and joy. She gave me Zazen. So tonight I chose this date because it seemed so far away from when she died in mid-January. And I thought, by then I'll be fine. This will be moved through my body. Well, guess what? It's not. So you will periodically see this arise, this energy, this phenomena arise in my body, but just okay. What it is longing, deep longing for my teacher, whom I miss greatly. And it will pass through my body. And then it'll happen again. So we'll just bear with it. So she and I, well, she ended up letting me put my name on this book with her, which Chuck illustrated. It's a little booklet called Zazen for Every Body. The Dharma Gate of Ease and Joy, Zazen for Every Body. And this book is basically her Zazen instruction. So it talks a lot in, you know, there's a chapter in here about how Zazen helps with pain. There's also exercises for doing Zazen. But in between are illustrated Zazen postures, the traditional postures as well as alternative postures. The lying down, two lying down postures, standing posture, and some different mudra for people with shoulder and neck pain. So this is really her teaching, her essential teaching on Zazen. And she and I collaborated on this booklet with Chuck for a couple of years, I think. And if anyone's interested in it, it is available at Zen Center, just so you know. But this to me, you know, she told me toward the end, at the end of her life, that this was so powerful to her that at the end, her last book would be a publication on Zazen in particular. Because when she was first diagnosed, she didn't think she'd be able to do Zazen. She thought she was going to have to give it up. Because she was at Green Gulch and Tassajara, and she just couldn't sit like everyone else. And at that time, that was really an oddity. I mean, nobody was doing what she was doing at that time. So she really opened up, I think, Zen in America to people like me, who, you know, who don't, can't just sit like everyone else and don't necessarily, have total comfort in the Zendo. She literally transformed my suffering in our first meeting. So she talked a lot about Zazen being a sort of dynamic tension, that dynamic tension is needed in Zazen to keep the body awake and alert. And that, you know, in Zazen, what we are doing is a practice of non-preference, that we are simply sitting, and we're with no particular object of focus, but also without following our stories, our typical habits of mind, and without, you know, without sort of preferring feeling good or not feeling good, or what's good for Beata or what's not good for Beata in that moment, but just this is what we're doing. This is what we're doing right now. We're sitting, and sitting still. So, you know, we don't have to know how to be together. The teaching, her teaching is, we're together with our bodies. It's a body-to-body practice of being together. And that's what Zazen is. It's a body-to-body practice. We meet it with our bodies. We engage it with our bodies. And she taught a teaching that Suzuki Roshi, I think, originated, at least in this country, which was that every part of the body does Zazen independently. Every part of the body does Zazen independently. So when you're sitting Zazen, how's your little toe? Little toe, your right little toe doing Zazen? So these are the questions that she put before us and taught. And she taught it by giving physical Zazen instruction. During Sesshin, she would walk and each person would receive personal, physical Zazen instruction from her. Last Sesshin I did with her was in October, end of October, and I was lying down. And I thought, oh, she won't find anything, you know, right? Like, we just wrote the book. And, you know, come on, I've got this down. And I'm laying there. I am in perfect posture, okay? And how could I not be perfectly aligned? I'm lying down. So I'm like, okay, and I'm like laying there. Okay, I'm good. And so she leaned over me, and she did this to my forehead. Is that right? So now every time I sit Zazen, I'm attending to my forehead. Is it relaxed? That's Zazen instruction, Darlene style. So she talked a lot about vulnerability, about no concepts mediating our experience. And that's what we practice in Zazen. We do Zazen, we practice. That's exactly what we're practicing, is working with studying the concepts that usually mediate our experience, so that we can, they can let go of us or we can let go of them, and then we can actually have the direct experience of what's happening. And so direct experience or meeting just this means meeting with all of you. What is there, what is occurring or what's happening, without a lot of thought about it, without a lot of knowing about it, or, you know, concepts in between me and it. This is not so easy. So we practice it and we practice it and we practice it so that when we're off our cushion, when it really matters and we're out there in the world and we're encountering what we encounter and being with what we encounter, we can meet it. We can actually be present for it. Have enough stability to meet it. I'll give you an example of about her teaching of non-preference that was extremely powerful to me, which was that at the end of November, I was, so one of the ways that I practiced with her, and many people practiced with her, is by living with her. So she would have you to her home, and you would live there with she and her poor, long-suffering husband, for 3 or 4 days. And just practice from morning till night with them. Cooking, eating, being together, going to Safeway, whatever was happening, you just did the next thing, only you did it together. And she said, my life is my teaching. Take what's useful to you. What isn't, leave. And so you just lived in her life for periods of time, extended periods of time, and that was the teaching. And so I went up there the end of November for a residential practice period of 4 days. And the day I arrived, she sat me down, and this was typical, and said, now here's what we're going to do. Okay, so for the last week or so, I've been having a lot of pain in the morning. This is just a matter of fact. I've been having a lot of pain in the morning, and so, I might call you up a little later. We'll just have to kind of play early morning by ear. And I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. So I went down and in the Zendo where I slept, and in the morning, promptly at 7:15, the same time as always, I got called up, and I was surprised. I went up to the house, and she was in a lot of pain, and she was dying of ovarian cancer, and she was having a lot of gastrointestinal side effects from chemotherapy. And she was in tremendous pain, and she was rocking and, kind of moaning and just really holding her pain. She wasn't putting her pain on me, or anyone else, but she was definitely visibly, she was meeting her pain and meeting it out loud and showing me that this is what we do. This is how we meet our lives. It's not always pretty. It's not always perfect. It's not always maybe the way the master looks, okay? But here's the master meeting her life completely and allowing me to witness that. And a very, very moving and powerful experience for me, who tends to deny my body and just press through it and not reveal my pain. And not tell anybody if I'm hurting or what's going on. Not that any of you would believe that, but I have a very big tendency to just buck up and take it because that's what I think I have to do. And she showed me very vividly, no, that's not what you do. Live it, so meeting it without preference. So she was just there with it. She wasn't preferring something different. I'm sure she would have liked to have not been in pain. But she was just meeting the pain with her whole body and mind. And she was so open and so vulnerable that she was willing to have me be there and observe that. Because she could have left me downstairs. She didn't have to bring me up right then. But she chose to do that. So I she then got up and we sort of put her in a little sofa that was at the foot of their bed, a settee at the foot of their bed, and she was lying there, and it was a Tuesday, and she was scheduled to give the talk at Healdsburg Sangha that evening. And so she said to me, this was maybe 11 o'clock in the morning, and she'd been lying down, shivering, freezing in, waves of tremendous pain all morning. She looks at me about 11 o'clock, she says, I need to get dressed. I said, okay. She said, I want you to get me dressed because I have a talk to give at 7:30 this evening. I said, okay. So we sat her up. I dressed her. She went right back down. It exhausted her completely to dress. So shoes and all, she lays back down, and she was shivering and sweating, and I had a strong need in that moment. And I didn't realize this until later, but looking back at this incident, I realized I had a great need to a preference for how to see this woman. That my preference was that she is my master. She is unflappable. She is powerful. She is strong. She is boundless. She is bottomless. And I need her to be that. So this was my preference. I did not see what was there. I missed just this because I needed something else from her. And so I sat with her. I stroked her forehead. I held her. I spoke with her. She said, "Oh, this is what I need. I need comfort." It was so beautiful. But the fact is, you guys, I missed it. And what I missed was that she had a fever. I missed that she was an old woman nearing death, that this suffering could be treatable, that perhaps some intervention was possible. But my preference, what was good for Beata, got in the way of me meeting her right where she really was that day. So we went through that whole day, and it wasn't until the next morning that Tony, her husband, said, "You know, I talked with her physician, and I think maybe we should take her to the emergency room." So I said, "Okay, so she's still in the same clothes." We get her up, take her down to my car. Now, I'm feeling very badly because 24 hours ago, I work with older people. I could have seen this, but I wasn't in my work mode. I was in my student master mode. I was in my, this is my great teacher mode. I couldn't let go in that moment of my own preference. And so she suffered because of that. And it's a very vivid example I have of how preference makes it impossible for us to see what's really happening. Because in fact, so then we decide, okay, so we get her up to take her, and she's standing now to go to the emergency room, and she gets really mad. She's mad. She's like mad. She's telling me, "I am so mad. I can't believe you're making me go to the emergency room when I have a haircut appointment this morning that I have waited a month for." I'm like, going, okay. So I said, "Well, you know, Darlene, I would cut your hair, but you know." And she said, "Yeah, you're obviously not trying to impress anybody." So my mind was not subtle enough to really see the whole truth in that moment. And you know, I think that's why that really clarified this teaching for me greatly, this teaching of what she means when she says just this, and what she means when she says you have to climb over the mountain of preference to see just this. You cannot even see it unless you climb over that mountain. And I think that's a very vivid example. So I would say Zazen and this idea of meeting just this with your whole body and mind is one major area of teaching that she gifted me. She was the most generous person I've ever met. So as many of you who have known me for years know, one thing that I tend to do in relationship, I really long to be connected with people. I love people, and I am a very much a people person, and I long to be connected. And the minute I connect with someone, I get scared, and then I run away. So this is the tricky thing. So I connect, and then I get scared, and I disconnect. There's a very powerful habit energy I have of, oh, this is scary, and pulling away. And, of course, you know, Darlene figured this out in about 3 minutes. And we were at a retreat in Fresno area, Women in Zen retreat, the first year I met her. So I met her maybe in March or April, and this retreat was in July, so a few months later. And so we didn't know each other that well, but the teacher, the person whose Zendo that is, who was leading the retreat, and Darlene was one of the teachers, one of four teachers, or three teachers, But another one of the teachers got a kiyosaku, you know, the waking up stick that you may know about, that we don't have one, but they're sometimes used in monasteries during long sits. And they're actually a helpful tool. I personally, it's not my thing, but it is a helpful tool, I understand. And so this teacher got a kiyosaku and was sort of, you know, I thought, my feeling that I had about it was kind of swaggering around with it, you know. And I thought in a little bit of a threatening way. I mean, to me, it felt that way. So I bring my karma, right? I bring my conditions there to that zendo. And I'm a trauma survivor. And I wasn't sure. It made me very nervous. I wasn't sure what she was going to do, really. I just didn't know. I'd never met her. I didn't know. And it scared me. And so I just, this incredible compulsion to leave. And as I just felt unsafe, it was her place. And here she was. So I waited until lunchtime. And I thought, there's about 25 people there. I thought, all right, here's my moment. Darlene won't even notice this. I'll just slip out and I'll just call some people. I'll get grounded and I'll slip back in. And, you know, she'll never know. So I left a note for the person in the kitchen, the cook, because I was due to chop vegetables at 3 o'clock. So I went in the kitchen, left a note. I'll be back by 3, don't worry. And I drove off. I left all my stuff. I was coming back, but I drove off. I got back about an hour later, and before I went from my car to the zendo, three people, "Have you seen Darlene? She's searching for you. She's been searching for you. Where have you been? Did you leave? Have you seen her? She's looking everywhere. She's very upset." So, of course, I'm Catholic, people. So I'm like, oh, my God. I better go get my punishment fast. So just, you know, so I searched around, you know, right away. I wanted to find her right away and get this over with. So she said, okay, come with me. And she's very somber. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is serious. So she walks me over to this other building and we sit down in Dokusan. And she says, "You left me." And I said, well, you know, I got nervous, and I've told her the story. And she said, "You know, I love you. And when you leave, I notice. Because I love you. We're connected." That was the first time anybody ever said that to me. It blew my mind. I'm not often speechless. I was truly speechless. And she said, "Well, are you telling me not to leave?" Because I'm still looking for the Catholic part, you know, the moral of the story. You know, I said, "Are you telling me not to leave?" And she said, "No, I'm not telling you not to leave. I'm asking you to stay connected with me when you leave. I'm asking you to tell me when you leave." She said, "Just tell me. Then I know. And I can hold you while you're gone." She taught me how to be connected and disconnect. How to do what I needed to do, but remain completely connected. That was transformative to me. And so later, I said to her, "Darlene, you know, wow." I mean, a couple of years later, I said, "Wow, you know, that really was so moving to me when you did that. That was such a powerful teaching. I'll never forget it." And she said, "Well, you know, Beata, many selves arose in that moment, and I chose that one to meet you." Another teaching. Now she's teaching with her teaching. And she's saying to me, "I could have met you in 15 ways. This was the one." And that's yet another deep teaching of non-preference. And of sort of skillful means, you know, she's been searching for me, but she drops that. She meets me. She takes me into her body, her and my energy together. And she thinks that what I need is to be loved. And so that's what she meets me with. Extremely powerful teacher in that way. Later, I started seminary with her, SPOT, And she was one of the three teachers there, and it was at the same location. And I had seen her several times in large group settings, and at one point we had Dokusan on Skype. So we did most of our Dokusan on Skype, and then we do these large group events or group events. And at group events, there was so much energy around her, so many people clamoring to be with her, and I usually felt like I had more of her than I, you know, really deserved, in a sense, you know, I mean, where I was so lucky to have so much exposure to her. So I would usually back off and just let other people have time with her. But I also started to sort of long for time with her, like, hey, man, you know, what about me? So in this Dokusan, I said that to her, basically. I said, oh, you know, Darlene, we go to these group events, and, you know, I long to be with you. I feel like, you know, I don't get really to be with you, and then there's just this big group. And I expected her to say, oh, you know, buck up, you know, get over yourself, whatever. What she said was, and I bet Malcolm could say what she said was, I long to be with you too. So from now on, the day before these big group events, let's talk to each other and figure out when we can have our time together during the event. Again, right there. Right where I am, there she is. And so she would call me on Friday before spot, say, okay, so here's the schedule, because she knew the schedule, I didn't. Okay, so here's the schedule, so I think I'm going to write my Dharma talk on Saturday morning between 11 and noon, so why don't you come bring a book and come over and sit in the living room while I write my Dharma talk? And I would do that. Or we would sit by the pool together. We didn't talk always during these times. They weren't Dokusan, but they were just our time. And so what she taught me with that was that it's okay to long. It's okay to want to be near someone you love. It's okay to have a human body with human needs, with pain, with weakness, with strength. And we can all meet that together. We can all meet that together. She had it too and made it okay for me to have that. So she essentially gave me special time. She didn't say, oh, nothing special, this is Zen, right? See? So she never pulled out the isms. That was what was so incredible about her. With a million opportunities to throw the Dharma at you, she never did that. She just met you as one human being to another. Oh, I long to be with you too. So let's make that happen. Astounding to me. Darlene felt that the core of the Mahayana school of Zen, or the Mahayana teaching, is the vow to be in the mess, as she put it. The vow to be in the mess. So we aren't so concerned with, you know, deep states of meditation that we, you know, work toward for years and, you know, and then try to maintain, you know, all the time. We're not so concerned with purifying the mind or, you know, doing rituals of purification or anything like that. We're concerned with intimacy. And intimacy is messy. So the Bodhisattva vow is about being in the mess. It's about skillful means. It's about being wherever beings need us to be in order to make ourselves available for their liberation. That's the Bodhisattva vow. And so that was her teaching. And she felt that that was the core of the Mahayana tradition. And she talked a lot about having enough stability in our practice to actually be intimate, to actually be present for it. And I mentioned that a little bit. So she talked about the dynamic tension of stability and vulnerability. Stability and vulnerability. And that we in Zazen, we work with stability and vulnerability, both. And we train the mind to come back, to come back, to come back. Just this, over and over. Leaving is good in Zazen, because it gives you the chance to train the mind to come back. And that's what we're doing, come back. It's a returning muscle that we're building. And developing that stability is essential to this Bodhisattva vow, because without it, You are at best a precarious bodhisattva. You're sort of dragged around by your own preferences, by your own your own wishes and longings, or by other people's energy or longings or needs. And that's not so helpful all the time. So having enough stability to be present in any realm, any hell realm, any heaven realm, any realm of pleasure or pain, wherever beings are, that's where we've said we'd be. That's why we practice. And many times, we each showed up as we were, and it wasn't always nice and neat. Sometimes it was messy. And I'll give you an example of that. I would drive about 3 hours to be there. And one time I arrived, and she would immediately want to bow in and start the practice days. And so I came upstairs, and it was raining, I believe, so I didn't want to sit in my car because I was afraid they would feel compelled to come down. So as soon as I parked, I went up to greet them, she and Tony, and then I was going to go and kind of reorient and ground myself. But there was no opportunity to do that, so we bowed in, and I'm sort of all over the place. Well, she picked that up, and she said, "You know, when you arrive here, you seem cool. You seem, a little distant." And it caused me to look at myself, to look at my arrival. And I realized I'm a bad arriver. I mean, I am. I'm a bad arriver. I arrive worried. I always arrive anxious. And I don't care. Am I going camping and I'm alone in my car? It doesn't matter. This is what arises in me on arriving. Arriving is a condition of anxiety for me. And so I would arrive and I would sort of not know how things were going to be, not trust the situation. So I would kind of scope it out. I would stand back a little, kind of, what's going on here? Okay, how can I quietly just flow into this so that I don't take up any space or move any air, because that might cause a reaction, right? So how can I just slip into this? So I'm trying to figure this out, and she said to me was, "You seem cool, and I feel nervous." She said, "I feel insecure. I think you don't like me." That's what she said. "I feel like you don't like me when you arrive here and you're cool and distant." And again, I'm like, I said to her, "I think I'm getting the lay of the land. I'm not sure how you're going to be, how Tony's going to be. I want to scope it out, make sure that I'm going to slip in as smoothly as possible." She said, "Beata, I will always be the same. I will always be the same when you come here." Okay. So we followed these moments of difficulty, or what we might call messiness in our relationship, with hours of dokusan. So one time we had a thing about money where I sent her a sort of scathing, or marginally scathing in my book, in her book probably extremely scathing, email about certain ways that money was being handled. And you know me. Kogyo knows this. So I brought this up in an unskillful email, and what I got was a call from Darlene saying, "I'm hurt. This hurts my feelings." And I was, of course, devastated. And she said, "So we have to have dokusan every day for at least an hour every day until we work this out." So every day for the next week, we had dokusan on Skype for an hour or two every single day until we both agreed that we were both okay. So that's a vow to be in the mess. No turning away from that mess. It hurt. She was hurt. I was hurt. Okay, here we are. Let's show up. Let's meet even more. Let's talk even more. Let's meet this. Let's meet it together. And during those conversations, she said to me several times, "Maybe you don't want to be my student anymore. Maybe I'm not a good teacher for you." And of course, I'm like, no, that's not. Of course, I said, "Maybe you don't want me to be your student," and we had to meet that. And But there was never any threat, never any taking away. I mean, when I first became her student, the very first time I said to her, would you be my teacher? And she said, yes. She said, I will never leave you. I will never leave you, she said. The only way this will end is if we sit face to face and decide this is over. Other than that, I will never leave you, no matter what happens. And I said, I will never leave you. And that turned out to be true. We both kept our word in that regard. So very powerful, very willing to just show up, to be human, to be in the mess, to be intimate, to meet it. And believe it or not, I cannot read this. So it was really a deep honoring of the question. You know, a deep honoring of the question. Don't make light of the question. Don't gloss over the question. Go deeply into the question. And if that takes, you know, 8 hours of Dokusan, then we will do 8 hours of Dokusan, whatever it takes. So she definitely showed that vow of... she definitely manifested and brought forth this vow of being willing to be in the mess and showed me how it might be done. One of the lessons that she taught me about that was to hold things lightly. She taught me how to hold things more lightly because I'm a very holdy person. And she taught me by example, but also by talking with me about it, how to hold things in more lightly so that with less preference, with less grasping, but still to hold it. If you love it, if it's important to you, hold it, but hold it lightly. It's a very powerful teaching for me as well. So Darlene, you know, because of her pain, she worked with a lot of emotional despair early on in her pain and anger and, you know, all the things that chronic pain brings. Anyone with chronic pain knows that there's a grief and just a lot of emotional suffering in chronic pain in addition to her physical pain. So one of her major bodies of teaching is called Suffering and Delight. That's her framework for it. And she says, and this is a quote from Darlene, we must penetrate our anguish and pain so thoroughly that illness and health lose their distinction, allowing us to just live our lives. Illness and health lose their distinction, allowing us to just live our lives. And I think until the bitter end, she modeled that and really showed that. So again, being intimate with the question, she asked me in 2009, to be her shuso. Now get this, this is a classic Darlene. Would you be my shuso in the fall of 2011? Okay. Oh yeah, sure, no problem. Would you give the Dharma talk on March 23rd? Oh yeah, sure. So everything seems so far away, you know. And so I said, yeah, of course, I would love to be your shuso. And she said, here's what you're going to do for your practice period. Okay. You are going to be despair for your practice period. I work a lot with despair. Despair and anxiety are my companions. And so she said, what I want you to do is I want you to come here for 6 weeks and lie down and be despair. And the Sangha will feed you and the Sangha will take care of you. And your whole job as shuso is to penetrate despair. That's all I want you to, that's your job. And we will bring you food, she said. We will bring you food. And I believed her. And I believed her Sangha. They would have done that for 6 weeks, brought me food, and made sure I didn't die in my despair. So honoring the question and being willing to be fully in it and not turn away from it in even the tiniest corners of it, to go completely into it and penetrate it completely, and thereby losing the distinction between hope and despair. Because as long as there's a distinction between hope and despair, then there's a what, it begins with P, a preference, and then there's what, we can't see just this, right? So we miss our experience. So she taught me that you can prefer everything, that you can live a life beyond what's good for you and bad for you, beyond pleasure and pain, actually that pleasure and pain are both suffering, in fact, both sources of suffering, and beyond hope and despair. So to summarize briefly, I would say having enough stability to be in the mess and a consciousness refined enough to practice all, to notice all the moment is full of, this is why we practice. This is how practice is intimacy, or about intimacy with our experience. This is just this. That intimacy is about how we are with the tiny things, how we eat our meal, how we put on our shoes, how we walk through the door, how we bow, how we do the dishes. This is what our practice is. This is what intimacy is. And, you know, she would say that, you know, we have a, if we, through practice, develop a consciousness refined enough so that in this vast and wide universe, we actually choose to put on our shoes. That in this vast and wide universe, we choose to get up in the morning and go to work. We're not victims of the alarm clock or victims of, you know, the rain, so we have to wear shoes or whatever. We are choosing our lives out of a vast and wide universe of endless possibility. That's her teaching. And then, of course, you know, preparing ourselves for it through practice. So I've just scratched barely the surface, but I hope I've given you some flavor of this great teacher and the vast, just huge, life-changing offerings that she made to me and hundreds of others. I get emails, multiple emails a week from people. The guy who did her web development, just to tell you, he does my web development now, and he did her web development, and he said to me, he never met her. He talked with her by phone about her website, and he did her website for a couple years. He took 2 days off after she died to grieve. That's how powerful a connector she was and is. So what questions or comments or thoughts do you have about what we've talked about? Or I guess what I've talked, I've done all the talking, so let me just own it. Malcolm? Thank you, Malcolm. I'm hoping we got your laugh on our recorder. Liz? No. She died. She died in January. So I was... it was due fall of 2011.
Oh,
yeah.
This fall.
Mm-hmm. This fall. Yeah. Thank you. Got out of that one. Maybe. Uh-oh. Yeah. Anybody else? Chuck?
Thank you so much for sharing what looked like many, many subtle but very dynamic teachings that she gave to you in a very personal way. And thank you so much for including me to work with both of you. Mm-hmm. And I never was really close to Darlene. We had our closeness through distance. Mm-hmm. But it still felt very intimate. And I know many, many times you were kind of critical of the fact that it took so long to finalize, you know, some of those illustrations. Mm-hmm. And it was just the next thing for me. Every time it was just the next thing, and it was fine.
Good.
And it was perfect.
Thank you. It was a hugely generous gift to us that you did that, Chuck, and they are beautiful illustrations. Actually, these are some of the most beautiful illustrations of Zazen posture I've seen anywhere. And she would say, no, those hands, you know, they just have to be just a hair closer to the hip. And I'm like, back to Chuck. Okay, Chuck, a hair closer. How wide as a hair, you know. and he would go and redo the drawing and move it a hair. So, and then it would be, well, that foot, you know, that foot. So it's very precise, and consequently, they're beautiful drawings that really do capture Zazen as we do it every day. Kathy?
Sharing it through your experience of receiving her, which makes it then something that's real for all of us. Mm-hmm. And so I'm feeling like one of the most powerful things that you brought forth was her meeting you with love in those moments when, you know, usually we would want to get defensive, or when the circumstance would have seemed to have inspired defensiveness, mm-hmm. or identity, or, you know, mm-hmm. some extra control or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm very stunned, you know, just the numerous examples mm-hmm. of her, and like she herself acknowledged, there's many selves I could have brought.
That's right.
You know, mm-hmm. and I know sometimes I feel like, well, I just react, mm-hmm. and then afterwards I go, God, I wish I would have reacted differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm really chewing on that. Wow, I wonder, you know, there was some way that even though she could acknowledge she could have done any different reaction, that was what mm-hmm. her commitment was. And so that was what really then came forth mm-hmm. to meet you. And how, what a teaching that is. And how life-changing mm-hmm. that is to be the recipient
yes.
of that clarity mm-hmm. about what really matters.
Yes, that's exactly, that's a great summation of that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Based on your experience with Darlene, can you give us a short answer? What is a teacher?
Someone who meets you where you are and then calls you to something more. Well, on a personal level, I think you do that all the time, because you personally, because I think you show up, and so then I have to show up. so I think you do that very well, actually. You know, fear is a powerful thing, and you know, it's a well-worn neurological pathway I have, and I try to recognize it for what it is. But it's something that is very compelling. It's hard to not respond to fear, you know. So what I've tried to do is just learn how to be more skillful in how I respond. But I still might disconnect. But I will tell you. maybe that's helpful. I don't know, but I think it's a way to stay connected, actually, to have a thread, but yet allow me to create some distance that I might need for a while to work out the fear, to let the fear, really, the phenomena of fear, pass through my body, which just takes time. And sometimes I just need space around me to let that happen, so that I can feel like I'm not going to hurt somebody else or be hurt. She actually felt that was a gift to give other people, to create a buffer when those kinds of intense emotions were happening. So she really taught me how to make that okay, but also how to stay, keep the thread, during that time. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So I'd like to do a little dedication of our time together this evening, and I want to just mention that some of you will recognize parts of this because I modeled this after the beautiful echo or a dedication that we chant for Mahapa Japati annually here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. From the suchness beyond pain and pleasure, Darlene lived in this messy human world with compassion and wisdom vast and wide. With great love and steadfast resolve, she encouraged others to find their own strength and realize their own shimmering uniqueness in the empty Dharma field. May her great spirit continue endlessly, and may her humorous, dedicated, formed and formless practice and devotion feed all hungry ghosts and bring understanding, comfort, and joy to all beings. Beings are numberless. Thank you.